KALW.
You know, the stereotypical thing with Mexicans is, oh, you drive a lowrider, a gangster car, you know?
Today we learn about lowrider bikes and how one bike club is working to change the perception of lowrider culture in Northern California.
They say, oh, you know, everybody out there is like gang members. I'm like, no, they're not. We do this all for the community. We're like trying to raise money for kids.
Then we'll hear from an activist who created a space for queer arts to be a form of wellness.
The notion of the space really was that art heals. Art heals. And that these are forms of medicine.
And we'll hear readings from three Bay Area authors, Vanessa Hua, Angela Terry, and Charlie Jane Anders. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Lowrider car culture first emerged in Southern California in the 1940s. When Mexican-American veterans returned home after World War II, many of them came back with new technical skills that had to do with vehicles. So they began to use their garages to repair and customize old cars. Then in the 70s, the Chicano movement helped inspire Mexican-American car enthusiasts to embrace lowrider culture. As its popularity grew, a wave of car and bike clubs sprung up across the country. KLW's DeAndre Ball has the story of one bike club in Napa that's trying to preserve the lowrider culture while also combating stereotypes and serving the local community.
Saul Vera is a chill, 19-year-old Napa native with a passion for all things lowrider. Customized, tricked-out, candy-painted cars, hydraulics, and shiny chrome bikes. He's also president of the Chelu Lowrider Bike Club. Chelo means brother or friend in Spanish. For lowrider enthusiasts like Saul, each bike is a blank canvas for artistic expression, not just technical function. Today, Saul's showing me his prized bike he made.
So this is my custom lowrider bike. I even got these spinners down here, those rims right there. Crazy hard to find.
We're at a vintage car show in Vallejo, where Chelo members have their bikes and cars on display. One is decorated with a Las Vegas Raiders theme. Another one, built by Saul, is shiny and silver and sits low to the ground.
It has hydraulics too, so it bounces up and down like a lowrider.
He says for many Mexican Americans, lowrider culture is about more than just flashy cars with cool paint jobs. The members of these clubs see themselves as passing on the torch to the next generation. A lot of the lowrider clubs like his also do youth mentorship, food and toy drives, and volunteer service for the surrounding community. Saul first started making lowrider bikes when he was 16. He finds bike parts through online ads and has traveled far to get the parts. For the one he's showing me today, he had to go all the way down to LA.
When I brought it back up here, I got two different bikes and I put them all together and I made this right here. So most of the parts on the bike are used. I just clean them up, you know, make them shiny again.
Saul initially started making lowrider bikes through online tutorials. He also gets help from his dad, who grew up making and selling bikes in Mexico. He got more involved in middle school through Chelo Club founder Pete Duenas. Pete started the bike club 10 years ago to provide young people with technical skills to build their own bikes and life skills towards a more positive future.
Because a lot of kids are distracted these years, you know what I mean? So our part is just to try to keep them focused on something positive.
And that's what Saul did. Dedicated himself to the bike club.
And I just eventually just made my way to the top, and now I'm president of Chelo Bike Club.
Some people built their own lowrider creations as models to rarely drive on the road. This is not the case for Saul. He loves to cruise around town with his friends on their lowrider bikes and feels proud to display this important part of their Mexican-American heritage.
A lot of people build their bikes like just for show, specifically for show. And I said, man, what's the point of that if you're not going to be able to ride it? When I go cruising, it's just a feeling like, oh, like the old school feeling. That's what gets me a lot. Whenever I go cruising with my friends, you know, we got the music all blasting loud. You know, we got the oldies. And we're just cruising around anywhere around our side of town, or we go downtown and everyone's just always staring at us. You know, everyone always has questions.
Along with mentoring young people, part of Chelo's mission is to dispel stereotypes about lowrider culture.
Yeah, so, you know, the stereotypical thing with Mexicans is, oh, you drive a lowrider, a gangster car, you know? Like, I personally have family members in my life right now that are telling me, like, don't be into this, bro, you're not a gangster. They say, oh, you know, everybody out there is, like, gang members. I'm like, no, they're not. We do this all for the community. We're, like, trying to raise money for kids. But, you know, they don't believe all that just because of how they were raised.
Not only does Chelu make eye-catching bikes, they do non-bike stuff, too. They host fundraisers, toy drives, and community potlucks. P says people, including some local politicians, have taken notice as well.
We have the mayor comes out and supports us. Congressman Thompson comes out and supports us. We get everybody involved. You know, the fire department, police department. This is, you know, we're a community car club. It's all about bringing the community together and giving back into the same community we live in.
Saul says the bike club has already influenced his life goals. He plans to enroll in college to become an auto technician. He wants to build his own lowrider cars. It's a goal that caught him by surprise.
I did not think I would be into cars, but now, like, seeing all these crazy lowriders and everything, you know, I want to buy myself one so I can learn. Like, everyone's telling me, all my family members are telling me, hey, buy a new car. You know, you're young. You could get the credit to, you know, buy a brand new 2022 car, you know? And I say, nah, I want a lowrider. I want an old school 1980s car.
Saul says he plans on keeping the lowrider culture alive for generations to come.
Once I do have kids, you know, this stuff isn't going away. I'm keeping my bike. You know, when you have a kid, you can raise them just to be in the lowrider lifestyle like me.
He doesn't have kids yet, but when he does, he's serious about immersing them in this tradition. He's already researched lowrider pedal toy cars and even lowrider strollers. In the meantime, until he gets his first lowrider car, you can find him and his friends biking around Napa, blasting oldies. In Vallejo, I'm DeAndre Ball for Cross Currents.
That was DeAndre Ball, a new graduate from our Audio Academy training program. You can hear more of his stories at KELW.org.
Is it true what they say about love? Said it sends a chill down your spine. Well, there's a chill going down mine, and this old phone of mine knows your number kind of well.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. As Pride Month comes to an end, the parties may be over, but not the need for LGBTQ+ community spaces. Early in the pandemic, activist Kin Folks created the East Bay Queer Healing Arts Center. Kin Folks has been a queer activist for decades. They were crowned SF Pride Grand Marshal back in 2018, and they were featured in the award-winning documentary State of Pride. KELW's Janae Darden spoke with Kin Folks.
Kin, welcome.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm so honored to be a part of this circle. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, I'm so happy to speak with you. And I haven't seen you in a while because of the pandemic. So Kin Folks, I love the name, Kin Folks. You know, it's Black vernacular, yes. Family.
That's right.
I think of family. I think of open arms. What inspired the name Kin Folks?
Ooh, that's an old story and I love telling it. When I was in high school, I went to a school where there were just a few speckles of us. And you know what I mean? Not a lot of children of color. And also, it was very difficult to be queer. And that wasn't the term that was used then, but that is the term that I embrace. And there was just a professor at the school, a teacher who was really active in their homophobia, their biphobia, transphobia, even before trans understandings of identities were really much clearer than they are now. And what was clear was the hatred and just how needless it was. And also I felt that they had a responsibility to be thoughtful and to guide us because that's what they're paid to do. So I just reminded this person in class that that's their job to be mindful and thoughtful. And that ended me up in the headmaster's office. And while I was being chastised by the headmaster and reminded that there's an order to things, there were some students that had heard that as I was leaving, I don't know where this soliloquy came out of me, but I said, you know, whatever you do to one of us, you do to all of us. You know, so when you see the one, you see the many. When you see us, just remember, we're all kinfolks, because that's the term I was raised with to, you know, transfer this idea of tribe and community and love and family. It's not just the quote unquote nuclear family unit. And so they showed up and I didn't realize that they were out in the hallway making a fuss saying that, you know, it wasn't my fault and teachers really should be teaching and respectful. And when the headmaster came out and started asking for names, they all said kinfolks, kinfolks, kinfolks. That was their name. Everyone took on the moniker kinfolks. And we all ended up, you know, in detention. However, we were really happy to continue to carry that name with us. And then when I went to a family reunion and my mother is Indigenous and Black, you know, one of the traditions in both communities is to really feel the energy of the person. So they might give you a name when you're born. However, you grow into your spirit name. And so kinfolks became my spirit name. And that's how it stuck.
And you do this work, you reach the spirits of people. And I'm hearing this spirit of community and help and kin and family. And that's something that I understand that you bring to the East Bay Queer Healing Arts Center. Now, it's only been around since 2020?
Yes. We started a long time ago. About 2009 is when we started Spectral Queer Media. And what we did is, it was myself and anything that I do is a we endeavor. It's never going to be just me. So, you know, I always look for people to collaborate, to co-found with, and we co-founded Spectral Queer Media. And it was really an opportunity for Black and Brown, you know, queer, trans-identified, asexual-identified, the LGBTQIA+ community to be able to promote our art and our voices in spaces where if we didn't come as a tribe, we wouldn't be seen.
So this evolved from Spectrum Media to an actual arts center. And I think the key for me in the name of this organization, the name of this space, is Queer and Healing Arts. What difference has this art center made for the people that you serve and the fact that this is a space for healing and creativity?
Oh, wow. So the space happened about a month before the shelter in place was, you know, put in order. We had no idea that when this space became, a truth for us, that we would be closing the doors so quickly. And the notion of the space really was that art heals, and that we all are creative beings in some way, shape, or form, and that these are forms of medicine, and that with everything that we know we're confronted with in this world and the ways in which we sometimes have a disconnect or a disjoint with our best selves or our healed up or healing selves in the world, that maybe art could be seen through the lens of any other practice, any other wellness practice. So we decided it has to have the word healing in it, because, you know, Oakland has a strong Black cultural underpinning. It's shifted considerably in terms of gentrification and our physical presence here in Oakland, which is a real, disaster. That's a disaster in the making right there, because Oakland and the Black and Indigenous love, genius, attention, labor that went into creating what Oakland is will be lost with the loss of our community presence and numbers. So I just want to say that because the Oakland that I know, because I came out here in 1988, it was very queer and gay and trans. Oakland was always, you know, that much more hospitable, even though the hostility in the media against Oakland had been, you know, enormous and disproportionate in comparison to the media representation of crime over in San Francisco, which we know was out of control too. I felt safer here. That says a lot, that I felt safer here. So we started, Black Pride started a while back. You know, anytime we were together, it was a Black Pride moment, because we, when we have a moment to celebrate each other, to see each other, to see each other well, we bring joy. And so, and what I'm saying, all Black people, we really do. We have a lot of trauma points, and the fact that we can come together and have barbecues and have family reunions and, you know, see each other and nod to each other in the street, there's a way that we still understand that it is our birthright, our spiritual birthright, to be here.
That was activist Kinfolk speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. That interview was produced with help from Porfirio Rangel. There's more information about the East Bay Queer Healing Arts Center at KLW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. Next, we're going to hear from a number of authors in a collection of episodes from KALW's literary podcast, New Arrivals.
This is New Arrivals, a pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Today, we'll hear three local writers read from their novels, which tackle love in their own ways. Vanessa Hua lives in the East Bay. Her book, Forbidden City, came out on April 19, 2022, and approaches the Chinese Cultural Revolution through the eyes of a young woman learning about power.
It's about Chairman Mao's teenage protege and lover who becomes a poster child for the Cultural Revolution. I'll read a bit from the beginning. The chairman is dead. September 9th, 1976. Outside, the people of Chinatown are cheering. They light firecrackers and beat pots and pans, chanting as they march three floors below the window of my apartment. Their signs say, "Smash the Emperor" and "Smash the Party." Drips of paint spoil the sweep and curve of the characters, bleeding as if shot. No longer will they whisper the chairman's name, afraid of his reach across the ocean to America. No longer will they invoke his name to scare their children or as a curse against their enemies. They didn't hate the chairman at first. None of us did. In the beginning, he was the beginning.
That was Vanessa Hua reading from Forbidden City. This next book is a very different kind of love story. San Francisco author Angela Terry's book, The Trials of Adeline Turner, came out in October of 2021.
It's about a single 30-something workaholic attorney who runs into her high school crush at the airport, which sets off a series of events that will turn her boring life upside down, but ultimately lead her to living her best life. I'm going to read the first paragraph of the book where Adeline is reminiscing about her unrequited high school crush because, one, it's one of my favorite parts of the book, and two, I think some of us can relate. Brad Summers was beautiful. There were no two ways about it. He had hazel eyes and the longest eyelashes I'd ever seen on a boy. His thick, wavy hair was coppery brown, and when the sun shone on it, glimmers of light bounced back. And his smile. Sigh. It was the broadest, friendliest, but almost shy at times smile, and my whole world revolved around seeing it. At age 16, he was already 6'2" and had the most perfect, long, lean limbs and athletic body. My stomach flipped at the mere sight of him. Everything was perfect, except for the fact that he didn't know I existed.
That was Angela Terry reading from The Trials of Adeline Turner. And finally, a book about love and friendship that takes place in space. Charlie Jane Anders lives in San Francisco. Her book, Dreams Bigger Than Heartbreak, came out on April 5th, 2022. It's the sequel to Victories Greater Than Death.
They're about a teenage girl named Tina, who's secretly the clone of an alien hero, and she and her friends have to go out into space and find ways to be heroes on their own terms. And here's one of my favorite passages. "You're going to be okay," Naitha says. "Whatever happens here, you will be okay." "You can't know that," Rachel says. "We all lose pieces of ourselves." Naitha shrugs one big purple shoulder. "It's part of being alive. Things slip through your fingers no matter how tight you hold on. Sometimes you get them back, right when you've given up, but they're never the same as before, even then. Sometimes they're gone forever, but maybe your real self is whatever remains after you've lost all of the things that you thought were you." "That's the worst inspirational talk I've ever heard." Rachel hugs herself.
That was Charlie Jane Anders reading from Dreams Bigger Than Heartbreak.
New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse, and there's more at klw.org/newarrivals. And before we leave you, here's some music to close out the month of June. This song is from the newly released album Half Yesterday from San Francisco band Flower Town. Today's Cross Currents team includes Hanisha Harjani, Sebastian Mignot-Buccelli, Sunday Holland, James Rowlands, Gabe Graben, Victor Tense, Shirin Adil, Shaya Levitt, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.